the divine souls. On the topic of practicing bhakti, I explained to you that there are certain conditions that we have to fulfill while we try to follow the path of bhakti. And I'm explaining you these conditions according to the statements found in our divine scriptures and made by our historical saints who showed us the path of bhakti. The first condition is that bhakti must be done with the mind. There are two types of bhakti, bahiranga bhakti and antaranga bhakti. The bhakti you do externally, meaning using your body or your senses to perform devotion, like singing, you use your voice, listening, you use your ears, to do puja, you use your hands. These are all external forms of devotion. But internal devotion can only be done with the mind. And that is the most important form of devotion, because the whole goal of bhakti is to purify the mind. And the only way the mind will become purified is if we join it with God. Thus, bhakti must be done with the mind. The external devotion can be used as a helper, but we must always remember that the essential form of devotion is remembering God internally. The next condition that we examined is this idea of being selfless. We saw that many of our scriptures and saints were saying that we should become nishkam. We should not ask God for anything. Do we know what to ask God for? People generally equate bhakti with asking something from God. But even if God fulfilled our every wish, would we know the right thing to ask him for? Remember the story of Dhruv, which I related to you yesterday, at the end of which Dhruv repented for having asked for a worldly thing. So we are like that child who is made to choose between a diamond and a chocolate bar and decides on the chocolate bar because he knows what a chocolate bar tastes like. He's tasted it before. He likes it. He doesn't understand the value of a diamond. Even if you tell him that with this diamond you could buy 1,000,000 chocolate bars, the chocolate bar is right there in front of him. He's more attracted to the chocolate bar than to the diamond. We are like that. We don't know what we could get from God, that God has divine anand. And when we ask him for the worldly happiness or worldly help, we're only asking him what we know. Like the blacksmith who, on the day that the king announced that he's going to give anything to anyone who comes to him, if it's within his power, today for the whole entire day he announced to his kingdom, anyone who comes to me and makes a request, I will fulfill that request as long as it is within my power. So people came from all over the kingdom. But two of the people who came to the king were of particular note. One was a blacksmith who came and asked for 2 50-pound bags of coal. The blacksmith requires coal in order to keep his fire burning hot so that he can heat the metal and then pound it into the shape that he needs. So he goes through a lot of coal. He thought, it's a good opportunity for me to get lots of coal from the king, and that way I'll be set for the foreseeable future. So he went and he asked the king for coal because that's all he could think of. That's all he knew. Another man came to the king and he said, King, my request is this. I want you to make me your son. The king said, I guess I can do that. I wasn't expecting that request, but it is within my power, so I have to grant you that request. But can I ask you, why are you requesting to become my son? You could have anything. I could give you anything, any amount of wealth, any amount of power, and you're asking to become my son? The man said, yes, because I know once I become your son, everything you have becomes mine automatically. So I don't have to ask for anything else. Do we have that much intelligence to ask God for the best thing, for the right thing? Or are we more like Hiranyakashipu, who thought he was intelligent when he got the boon? He said, I should not die in the day or in the night, inside or outside, in the air or on the ground, by any beast of Brahma's creation, nor by the hand of any human, nor by any weapon. He applied the full strength of his intellect, thinking that now with all of these details I have gotten in my boon, surely I will become immortal because I will never be able to die. But Bhagwan was smarter. He said, I will both honor the stipulations of Brahma's boon and I will kill you. He came as Narsingh, half man, half lion. So he's not a man, he's not a human, nor is he any beast in Brahma's creation. Nor did he use any weapon, he used his claws. And he kept Hiranyakashipu on his knees, meaning he held him in his own lap, so he was neither in the air nor on the ground. He took him in the threshold of the doorway so that he was neither inside nor outside, and he killed him after the sun had set but before it was dark. It was twilight, so it was neither night nor was it day. So he honored all of the stipulations of the boon given to Hiranyakashipu by Brahma, yet he still found a way to kill him. So we do not have intelligence to match God. We know he is sarvagya. He is all-knowing. So why not leave it up to him? Just say, God, I am yours. In other words, we could choose to just submit ourselves to God and leave the rest up to him. Say, God, I am your son. I am your daughter. I'm in your hands. Whatever you want to give me or not give me, that's up to you. At least we should have that much trust in God. So we surrender ourselves and leave the rest up to him. What if God went on fulfilling our every worldly desire? Let's examine it from that point of view. Let's say, whatever we asked for in this whole world, God fulfilled that desire for us. What would be our outcome, personally? What would that do for us? I gave you a couple of examples in my previous speeches on the nature of worldly happiness, where people were able to enjoy this world to an unbelievable extent and yet still found themselves dissatisfied. Like the great king Yayati, who enjoyed ruling the entire earth as an emperor for 1,000 years with this intention that I'm going to enjoy the world so much ki mera pet bhar jayega. That I'll just feel like, okay, that's enough. I don't need anything more from this world. That was his intention. He had switched with his son, taking his son's youth, and his son took his old age because he wanted to be able to enjoy the world. But he said, son, I'll only keep your youth for as long as it takes me to become satisfied with all of these worldly enjoyments. Then we'll trade back. I'll give you back your youth and I'll take my old age. But after 1,000 years of effort, he decided it's futile. No amount of worldly enjoyments will satisfy a person. I gave you the example of Hanuman and Surasa, that as Surasa opened her mouth to swallow Hanumanji, Hanumanji doubled the size of his body so that she couldn't fit him inside of her mouth. So then she enlarged her mouth, but Hanumanji again doubled the size of his body. In that way, our desires and our effort to fulfill those desires go on in an endless competition. The more we give our senses to enjoy, the more our desires go on multiplying. Which is why we say, worldly desires are even greater than God. Because God can be attained, but never in the history of humankind has it happened that a person fully satisfied all of their worldly desires and just felt at peace. And all of their restlessness and dissatisfaction was gone forever. Never has it happened. The more you get, the more your desires multiply. So if God were to go on fulfilling our worldly desires, what would be our state? The exact same as it is now. We don't normally think of it that way. But when you think that the cow gets the same enjoyment eating nice green grass as the king gets by enjoying his royal delicacies prepared in his palace's kitchen, they're both basically getting the same happiness from that. The happiness of eating. So you could say, yes, perhaps those delicacies that the king enjoys, they may be of a little higher level than the cow's grass. But the cow's getting the same basic pleasure that the king is getting. We look at the world around us and we think, if I had that, I'd be more happy. If I had that, I'd be more happy. This person has more than me, so they must be more happy than me. But we just assume these things. If we went and actually got to know that person, interviewed them, we would find out their level of happiness is the same as our level of happiness. The person who immigrates to New York from some outside country and comes and rents their first apartment, that happiness they get, that I got my own place, even though it's small, the kitchen and living room and bedroom are all in the same place, but I have my own place. That person enjoys the same happiness as the one who buys his first house out in Long Island. Now he's got 3 acres. And a big house with multiple rooms for his family when they come and visit. Before, when his parents came to visit, they all had to sleep in the same room, put mattresses on the floor. And now, when his parents come, he's got a whole wing of his house where he lets them stay. He can have multiple relatives staying with him at the same time. But is his happiness in owning this new big house actually more than the happiness he had when he rented his first apartment? No, it's not. So the happiness doesn't multiply according to the possessions. We can go on multiplying our possessions and our happiness does not multiply accordingly. So if we go on asking God and God were to go on fulfilling our desires, what would we get? We wouldn't really get anything out of that. You know, it might surprise you to learn that God has his own different philosophy from ours, which he has stated in the scriptures. When Shri Krishna did the Leela of telling all the Brajwasis not to worship Indra, he had a plan in mind. A couple of things that he wanted to accomplish through this Leela. He said, first of all, look at all these people. These are my people, people of my village, my relatives, my own parents. They're worshiping Indra, and I am Bhagwan. I've taken avatar here on this earth. At least I have to leave my mark in this way, that I should show people they should worship Bhagwan, not the devtas of Swarg. Indra is just an employee of God. He lives in Swarg. If you worship Indra, you can go to Swarg. You won't reach the divine world. And since Indra is only a material being, Indra has the same mental afflictions that we have. Desire, jealousy, ambition, envy. So he wanted to teach Indra some humbleness. Indra was feeling, I am so great. I am the king of Swarg. He had forgotten his place, that he is under Supreme God. He is not God himself. So Shri Krishna convinced his parents and the rest of the Brajwasis not to do puja to Indra, but instead to do puja of Govardhan Hill, which is in fact another form of Shri Krishna. Shri Krishna himself has come in another form as Govardhan Parvat. So after Indra made it rain, since he was so angry that Krishna, this little boy, had made all the Brajwasis stop worshipping him, and he made it rain for 7 days and seven nights, and eventually, after Shri Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill to protect all the Brajwasis, Indra realized his mistake and came to Shri Krishna and apologized and asked for his forgiveness. So Shri Krishna said, Tam bhranshayami sampadbhyo yasya chechamyanugraham. And yasya hamanu grihnami harishye taddhanam shanaihi. He says at another place. Both of these quotations are from the Bhagavatam. In the first one, he's saying, the one upon whom I wish to bestow my grace, I tam bhranshayami. Bhranshayami means for a person to fall or to cause that person to fall. And in the other statement, he's saying, tad dhanam shanaihi amanu grihnami harishye. I take away the wealth of the one upon whom I wish to bestow my grace. So in the first place, he's talking about someone who has status, power, influence, fame. If someone is like that and I wish to bestow my grace upon them, what will I do? I will do something to cause them to fall from that position of status, power, and influence. And the one who has great wealth, what will I do? Shanaihi means slowly, gradually. Harishye. I start taking away the objects of their attachment. I start taking away their wealth. This completely contradicts our philosophy, doesn't it? Our philosophy is, when Bhagwan graces me, I win the lottery. When Bhagwan graces me, I get a promotion at work. When Bhagwan graces me, everything goes right in my life. And Bhagwan is saying the exact opposite. When I grace you, you start losing the things that you're most attached to. Why would Bhagwan have such a philosophy completely opposite to our philosophy? He explains, Tulsidas ji, in fact, tells us, Nahi ko as janma jagmahi prabhuta pai jahi madnahi. He says, there is no one born in this world who, if they receive prabhuta, they receive wealth and power, that they will not receive mud. Mud means the intoxication that comes with having wealth and power. We may think, oh no, it wouldn't happen to me. But you know how if a person is drinking some alcohol, when they've had some alcohol to drink, their mind is starting to become intoxicated, and if you ask that person, are you okay to drive? They'll say, oh yes, I'm fine. It's great. Their mind is intoxicated, and who are they asking to judge whether they are in a good state of mind to drive or not? They're asking their intoxicated mind. Mind, are you okay to drive? Mind says, oh yes, we're good to go. In the same way, our mind becomes intoxicated with having wealth and power. So when we have these things, we ask our intoxicated mind, mind, you're not being affected by having this wealth and power, are you? Mind says, oh no, not one bit, we're just fine. But Bhagwan knows. So Bhagwan starts slowly, not all at once normally, but slowly taking away these things so we feel a little pinch, and then after the pinch we feel akinchan. Akinchan means destitute. You don't always have to be destitute to feel destitute, but it helps to lose something. This is why when Bhagwan Shri Krishna told Kunti to ask for a boon, Kunti surprised him by asking for something which you've probably never heard anyone ask for before. Vipada santu na shashvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam yatsya dapunar bhava darshanam. Please give me misfortune at every step of my life. Misfortune and loss. Shri Krishna was surprised. Why are you asking for such a thing? So she explained. Janmaishwarya Shruta Shribhi Redhaman Madha Puman Naivar Hatya Bidhatum Vai Vama Kinchana Gocharam. She says, it is seen in the world, and I know from my own experience, that if someone has a high and noble birth, they're born in a respected family, they have some pride of their status. If they have power, if they have influence, then they have pride of that. If they have wealth or beauty or strength or intelligence, whatever high quality they have in their character, they get a pride of that. Oh, I am the most intelligent. I'm wealthy. I'm beautiful. She says, whatever we have that's great, that thing gives us pride, and that pride becomes an obstacle in us surrendering to you, because tvam akinchana gocharam. You are attainable by those who are akinchan. Akinchan means from inside we feel destitute. Like, Krishna, you alone are mine. No one else is mine. I have nothing without you. That is the feeling of being akinchan. Can a person who has $1 million in the bank feel that? It's possible, but very rare. There's a saying, ihai vai kasya namutra amutrai kasya no iha, iha cha mutra chai kasya namutra. Traikasya no iha. There are four kinds of people in the world. There are those who have and do not have. There are those who do not have and have. There are those who have and have. And there are those who do not have and do not have. The first two are normal. And the second two are very rare. What is the meaning of this? Those who have and do not have, first of all, what do they have? They have sansar. They have aishwarya, dhan, shri, beauty, wealth, power, all of these things that give us this pride. They have that, and they don't have a feeling of surrender for God. This is very normal. We see it in the world. Conversely, if someone doesn't have, then they have. What does that mean? They don't have anything in this world. They've lost many things. They feel themselves to be destitute. And they have devotion to God. This is also normal. We see it happen. This is why Tulsidas ji says, Sukh ke mathe sil paro naam hiye te jaye balihari va dukh ki jo pal pal naam ratay. He says, oh Bhagwan, please let that happiness, let that thing of attachment be destroyed, which makes me forget you. And that suffering or hardship, which makes me remember your name every moment, balihar to that. How great is that suffering that makes me remember you? The next two type of people are those who have and have, and those who don't have and don't have. These two are very rare. In other words, those who have money, influence, beauty, all of these things, and they have a humble devotion to God. Not just that they're giving money to build a temple to be noticed, but a humble devotion to God. Even while having such great sansar, this is extremely rare. And those who don't have anything in this world and still are not surrendered to God, that is also very rare. Thus it is said, artho narthasya karanam. The main cause of the downfall of a person's character is arth, wealth. Because if it is not used for one's spiritual progress or for charity, then what will we use wealth for? Will you simply use that wealth to enjoy the world? That and nothing more. Or even worse, we may use our money to do wrong things, to try to gain more wealth and more influence. So wealth can be a very dangerous thing. Power can be a very dangerous thing. That's why Vedavyasji says, Yavad bhrieta jataram tavat svat. Tvam hi dehinam adhikam yobhimanyeta saste no dandamarhati. Bhagavatam. How much wealth should one hang on to for their own, to have as like disposable income? He says, just enough to keep your belly full. Any more is dangerous. Jatare, he says, just enough for your belly. That's it. If you have more, give it away. There are so many good causes in this world, so many people who don't even have enough money to fill their belly. Help those people, because if you hold on to that wealth, then it's dangerous for you. Number one, sasteno dandamarhati. Bhagwan Vedavyas says, you'll be treated as a thief according to the law of karma, because you accumulated more of God's earthly things for your own self and hoarded it for your own enjoyments, while there were others living on this same earth, your own brothers and sisters, who didn't have enough. And the other danger being, with that wealth at our disposal, we'll only use it to multiply our worldly desires, which will take us farther and farther from God. So Shri Krishna tries to help us. We may not like it. We may be like that little kid holding on to a toy. He thinks it's a toy because it's shiny, but it's actually a knife which could cut him. He picked it up on the floor. And his mother sees, oh no, he's picked up a sharp knife. So she wrenches it out of the baby's hand and the baby cries. And is angry with his mother. But his mother knows what's good for him. In the same way, we should believe that God knows what's good for us. So will he give us all the things that we're asking for? If he knows what's in our best interest? No, he's going to try to steer us in the right direction, even if we resist. See, one time there was a wealthy Sethji, a very wealthy businessman. He used to like to go to Vrindavan and bathe in Yamuna River. But he would choose a ghat which was a little out of town. Because sometimes on the popular ghats, there are people, we call them pandas, they wait and they ask for or even demand a donation. That, okay, you've come to Vrindavan, now you should give me a donation and then go and take your bath in Yamuna or take your bath in Ganga. So he wanted to get the punya of bathing in Yamuna River, but he didn't want to give any donation, even though he was extremely wealthy. So he went well outside of the town to a deserted ghat. Now Shri Krishna decided it was time to help this Sethji loosen his grip a little bit on his wealth. So he appeared as a panda over there on that remote ghat where this Sethji was going to take his bath. And Sethji came and he thought he was going to be in the clear, and all of a sudden there's this panda waiting for him. So Shri Krishna, in the form of the panda, says, "Oh, Sethji, you should give some donation. Now you're going in Yamuna River. You'll get more punya for that. So you should at least give, you know, 1 lakh. Sethji says, 1 lakh? Are you out of your mind? Okay, then at least give 1,000 rupees. Sethji was not even willing to give that much. Shri Krishna said 100 rupees. Sethji kept bargaining with him till they came down to 1 paisa. Not even 1 rupee, a fraction of a rupee. So Shri Krishna is thinking to himself, something is better than nothing. We have to get him started somehow, right? So he thinks now he's going to at least get this 1 paisa out of this Sethji. But Sethji wasn't done bargaining yet. He says, I'll give you the 1 paisa, but you have to come after the harvest. My fields are going to be harvested in a few months, and once they've been harvested and I've sold that grain, then you come to me. He told Shri Krishna where he lived, which was quite far actually from this place. So Sethji was thinking, who's going to come that far for 1 paisa? So he thinks although he's made the promise to give a paisa, he thinks probably he'll never come to collect. So anyway, Shri Krishna had to agree to that even. Sethji bathed, took his holy bath in Yamuna and left, went back. And a few months passed, the harvest came. One day, lo and behold, that panda, Shri Krishna, shows up at Sethji's door. He knocks. And a servant answers and asks, you know, oh, who are you and why have you come? So Shri Krishna tells him, I'm that panda from that we met that day on the ghat, and I've come to collect the 1 paisa that I was promised. So he goes in, he says, just please wait one moment. And he goes in and he tells Sageji, Sageji ghabra gaye. Aagaye? He says, tell him I'm sick. Go, he'll go away. Just tell him I'm sick. So the servant goes back to the door and he tells Shri Krishna, you know, Sageji is very ill, so he can't meet with you right now. Oh, he's ill? Well, I can't leave him like that. I'll have to see him, give him my best wishes. I'll help take care of him. He says, please wait. He goes back and tells Sageji. Sageji tells him, tell him I died. So the servant goes back and he opens the door again and he says, I regret to inform you, it's a very sad day. Sageji has passed away. Shri Krishna says, in that case, I'll have to stay to perform his last rites. The servant asks him to wait again. He goes back in. Sageji says, okay, what can we do? Maybe he'll lose interest somewhere along the line. So Shri Krishna comes in. They're going on with this whole act. Sageji is going on with this whole act. Now he's pretending to be dead. The next day they're carrying his body to the Shmashan Ghat. They're going to cremate him. So even then, Sageji is not willing to give his 1 paisa. He's taking it this far. They get to the Shmashan Ghat. They put him on top of the funeral pyre. They're about to light the funeral pyre. And finally, Shri Krishna says, forget the paisa. Sageji baith gaye. So we're like that. We're so stubbornly attached to our worldly things. And Shri Krishna is trying to find a way to, how can I get these people to release their grip on these worldly attachments? He's trying to help us. You know, when we ask God for worldly things, what is it showing? It's actually showing we've forgotten the basic premise of why are we doing bhakti in the first place. Come all the way back to the beginning of this series of speeches, when I explain the ultimate aim of life. The ultimate aim of life is to attain happiness. Anand. Where is that anand? Is it in the world or is it in God? We learned that it's in God. The nature of God is anand. And the nature of this world is simply temporary, fleeting pleasures which never give us full happiness. They give us a temporary excitement that doesn't satisfy us, but instead multiplies our desires to get more. So we always live in the hope of finding happiness in this world with passing excitements that we enjoy for a short time, but we never live in actual happiness. We live in the hope of finding happiness in this world. This is a fact of our life. Anyone who examines their own life would have to accept this fact. That doesn't mean we don't need the world. We do. We also discussed the whole situation that since we ourselves are a duality, our true self being the divine soul, which inhabits this material body. So we do need the material world because we have a material body. So the world is necessary for our body. But happiness can only be found in God. So divine God is for our divine soul, and the mayic world is for our mayic body. So my point is never to teach you that we don't need the world, or you should abandon the world, abandon your duties, That is not what I'm teaching. But we have to recognize that when our ultimate goal is to attain divine happiness, and we know that that is only can only be accomplished by surrendering our mind to God, then you have to ask yourself the question, if when I'm doing bhakti, I'm asking God for material things, have I even understood the goal of doing bhakti? No, I've forgotten, right? The goal is to join my mind with God so that mind will be purified. When it's fully purified, I'll receive God's grace. Then I'll receive divine happiness from God. This is the sequence. So if I am asking God for worldly things, is my mind actually in God? It is not. Whatever you're desiring, that's where your mind is. See, take an analogy. If a person goes and begs a doctor in the middle of the night, please come and treat my son. Please come and treat my daughter. Let's say you live out in the country somewhere. You're in a remote location where there's no close hospital. But there's a country doctor who sees patients. It's the middle of the night and you realize that your child has a very high fever. You don't know if they'll survive until the morning. So you go to the doctor's house and you rap on the door in the middle of the night. After some time, the doctor finally comes and answers. And he's wondering, what do you want? Why are you disturbing me in the middle of the night? You may fall at the doctor's feet and beg the doctor, please come and look at my child. They may die at any time. Please quickly come. You may even cry tears and clutch the doctor's feet. It looks like you have great bhakti for that doctor, doesn't it? You're in front of the doctor. You're bowing down before him. You're clutching his feet. You're crying tears for him. But is your bhakti for the doctor? Is your mind attached to the doctor? No, your mind is attached to your child. You're beseeching the doctor, but your mind is in your child. So wherever your mind is, that's where your attachment is, and that's where your bhakti is. So you have bhakti for your child, you don't have bhakti for the doctor. Now, take this, our situation. When we ask God for worldly things, are we doing bhakti of Bhagwan or are we doing bhakti of this world? We're doing bhakti of the world, not of Bhagwan. We want to use God to get what we want from this world. So our attachment is in the world. Our attachment is not in God. Then how will our mind become purified? It means condition number one has not even been fulfilled, that our mind should be attached to God. Our mind is still in the world. So we're like those people. There's a story that there were four or five men one night in Mathura. They got in a boat in the middle of the night deciding that let's paddle this boat down the river, down Yamuna River. Let's go to Prayag from Mathura, Vrindavan. Yamuna River keeps flowing downstream all the way to Prayag, the confluence of Ganga and Yamuna and Saraswati. So they decided, yes, it's a good idea. Let's get in this boat and we'll just paddle all night and by morning we should reach Prayag. So they got in, they paddled the whole night, and by morning as it started to get a little light and they looked at the banks of the river and all the buildings and everything, they were starting to think that isn't it interesting that how similar everything in Prayag, everything in Allahabad looks compared to Mathura? They look so alike. These buildings match up. Another one saying yes. In fact, that very building looks like the exact same one on the ghat where we left off from. Yes, it does. You're right. Then another one says, this is Mathura. We're not in Prayag at all. And the fourth one looks back and sees, oh, the boat was tied up the whole time. We paddled the whole night and we didn't get anywhere because we forgot to untie it from the ghat. That's how we are if we're doing a lot of prayer to God. So it seems like, just like they're paddling the whole night, right? They're putting so much effort. We're doing a lot of prayer to God, but our prayer is for worldly things. Then our boat is still tied up to the ghat. Our mind is not getting more attached to God. It's just getting more attached in this world. But the question still remains, when we have examples from our history of people like Dhruv, who did ask God for worldly things, and Draupadi, who did ask God for worldly things, and God did fulfill their desires, then why do we have these stories, and yet the logic and the philosophy seems to contradict this kind of prayer where you're asking God for worldly things? So the question still remains, is it okay to ask God for worldly things? Will he fulfill our desires if we ask him? But those questions will have to be answered in the next speech. Boliye Vrindavan Bihari Lal Ki Jai.